The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2, there's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
Greetings and salutations, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his long-lost gypsy brother, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 27 of The Big Picture for the week beginning August 31. Coming up on today's show, Bill Bryson's dream comes true. Robert Redford plays him in a movie.
My own dreams come true because we're going to get to talk about this great new film, Me, Earl and the Dying Girl.
And the stuff that dreams are made of, Drew Barrymore, Shirley MacLaine and William Shatner in the same show.
In the same show?
Unbelievable. Well, welcome to another episode of The Big Picture. This one, if I do say so myself, has something of the human touch. We've got films about growing old.
Because we've moved from being cyborgs to being human now, finally.
Normally, we're a bit mechanical. But today,
not today,
it'll be a little bit more interesting. We've got films about growing old. We take a walk in the woods with Robert Redford and Nick Nolte. And films about friends who stick by you no matter how footsore or crotchety you get. Our top five friendship films, in fact. We've even got films about what it's like for friends to face it, death together. Me, Earl and the Dying Girl's coming up.
Fantastic film.
Can't wait to talk about that. Got to hang around the show for that. And also stay tuned for every point of the human compass as we touch them off one by one. But first, Ben, a program about what it means to be human.
Mark, you're correct. We're going to talk first up now showing this segment this week on the series Humans. It's based on a Swedish television success
story.
Everything
good comes out of Scandinavia, it seems.
it so does, but we're talking about the new British-American co-production of that original series, Humans. And it's got so much cultural input, right, that show? Just by saying Swedish and British and
Swedish,
American
British,
all in one
American.
Sentence. Yeah, so how could it be anything but informed, this program? It's a new 8-part series. It's currently airing on the ABC, and it imagines what might happen to society when human-looking robots, or synths, become the next must-have consumer product. So it's a little bit like today's iPhones or iWhatsits, but Siri not only makes sense, she's now got curves and a bodily form. Ooh. But these techno success stories don't only raise sales, they raise questions about slavery, about racism, and even whether being human is more a moral question than a physical one.
This is the best thing you will do for your family.
You brought it into the house and we don't know anything about it.
It's a machine.
I don't take orders from you.
Your pulse is elevated. You should sleep.
I helped create you.
I am a man. I'm not perfect. None of us are.
I'm watching you.
I'm watching you too, Laura.
This is a really good television show. I mean, I like to be able to say that every now and again, just in case
it's nice to
wonder.
Be so upfront and get to the point. It's a good show.
Because I'm so crotchety about stuff often. I just feel that it's worth saying, straight off the bat, Humans is a really good production. It's made by, as you said, an American-British co-production. It's made by Channel 4 in
Swedish
the
Swedish original, though, Mark.
Thank you. Yes, it was originally called Real Humans in the Swedish version.
In Swedish?
And like most modern things, they just cut it down by one word and just went, oh, we'll repackage it. But it's actually... Look, interestingly, the American side of the equation is Xbox Entertainment. And Xbox Entertainment, as you know, is a spin-off company of Microsoft. Okay, so just like Netflix, which is another
every single company ever is trying to get into producing TV programs now.
The new wave of television production is basically coming through streaming services. And Microsoft has been streaming stuff in the United States through Xbox for years. Okay, and so now they're a production house. Why not? They've got enough money. So really, the same thing's happening with Sony. Same thing's happening with Netflix, as you know. So great television is coming out of these things. And Humans,
so that's the American side. But the British side, this is set in Britain, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's set in Britain. It's basically a story about the emotional impact of human-looking devices in our lives. You know, what if the toaster is so intelligent, in fact, that it's walking around, picking up the bread, slicing it for you, and then putting it in, and then somehow grilling it?
I'd love to live in a world with human-sized toasters.
I think so. But the problem is that they basically explore the problems of what happens when we start to relate to these devices. Are they human, and so therefore should we relate to them as other humans, or are they merely machines, and so we should relate to them like the same way we'd relate to a toaster?
It sounds like there's possibly a slavery vibe going on in this show, right? The synths being treated like slaves. So is that where the show goes to? Is that the sort of the biggest challenge in the show? Is it calling viewers to think about that?
Well, it's right, because there are basically sort of three woven storylines as the series starts off. There's a family of five. There's an aging guy with a helpmeet sort of synth.
Played
robot.
By William Hurt.
Yeah,
he's in this, isn't he?
Yeah, William Hurt's in this. Also, actually, look, The Family of Five has Catherine Parkinson. Now, most people might know her from the IT Crowd, okay?
So, oh, man, I don't really have much time for her. Is she good in this?
Yeah, that's it.
Because she's the weak link in the IT Crowd.
Well, she's the serious acting, you know, voice.
Good
in
on
this
her,
one.
Little
she's
scamp. Really
there you go. But then also there's a bunch of synths who've achieved human consciousness, or maybe something more, and they're trying to just avoid being turned into these disposable perpetual servitude devices.
Okay, so it is about slavery.
So slavery is it's very much about slavery, but it's also about more than that. It's about racism. You know, in a sense, if you think about it, you can actually look at all of these issues. This is the beauty of science fiction again. You can look at all of these things in very real terms today. So, for example, somebody looks at a robot and says, it's taking human jobs. And that is the same argument, so therefore it's bad. It's the same argument that's often put to immigrant workers. You know, here they are coming into our society and taking jobs, and I can't be what I want to be because of them. You know, so there's this sort of undercurrent of hatred that goes on of something that's different. But then, you know, there's also the idea of just the abuse of technology. There's the idea of the loss of memory. You know, if I could have a device that followed me around and remembered everything perfectly, would that make me a better person? Or would that make me a worse person?
That's a pretty cool
because
question.
I can remember.
But is there also, sounds like this show probably feeds a lot of ideas of resentment too from the human side towards the robots, like the slavery, racism ideas, but also maybe humans getting jealous about these perfect so-called creatures that they're imperfect. Does resentment
there's
sort of show its head here?
Yeah, there's some beautiful family dynamics that get set up. Like, for example, there's a man who has a wife who's been seriously injured. So she gets a synth in who's basically a physiotherapist to help her. But she chooses to have a synth who's basically a hunk. You know, I mean, he's a 45, you know, 50 sort of spread man.
Like a dreamboat like you.
Yes. Well, it's a good thing it's radio, don't you think? But like, I mean, it's true that the potential for us to start transferring our emotions over to things that look very, very human starts to put all sorts of tensions and resentment inside that marriage, okay? There's resentment inside the family's dynamic because some of the children don't want to go to school anymore because what's the point?
So it's more resentment between the humans rather than towards the synths.
Well, there's resentment towards the synths. But I guess the major factor is that what it does is it reveals for us what happens when we apparently get everything we want. Do we actually become better people?
Yeah,
or does
yeah.
it just start showing the sort of the fracture points on our personalities?
So then, like, sort of summing up humans, this is a couple of episodes in at the moment, isn't it? Like, it's about the fourth or fifth is airing
so
at the moment.
This week, you'll see episode 5 coming up.
Yeah.
But like, you know, the good thing about sort of streaming TV is you can easily catch these things up.
Yeah.
But I would say that one of the interesting ideas, like if I was pushing anywhere, I'd say, look at the way that this series handles work, okay? Because normally speaking, if we talk about work, you know, one to the other, we're always talking about the drudgery of it, okay? Oh, it's really, really bad, you know, this is a terrible sort of thing. And so you would think that if synths came into a society and took away all the drudgery, I never had to wash up again, I never had to worry about the laundry or walking the dog or anything.
This idea of being careful what you're wishing for, I think, is what you're driving at,
right?
Yeah. Like, we want for that, but in the reality, if we got it, and you're saying in work, would happen?
The weird thing is that, if you compare this to the Bible's idea of work, we actually get a polar opposite view. And I think humans plays that out for us. You see, the Bible looks at work as something that we were designed to do. It's not sinful. It's not bad. It's not something that's a part of a curse on humanity. It's actually something that we find meaning through. So when you look at humans, the series, and those characters who have suddenly sort of been set free from that drudgery, what are they? Purposeless. They've got nothing. They're not growing. They're frozen. They're spending their time playing video games instead. They're not developing as human beings. And it's kind of interesting, I think, that concept, the Bible concept, that work actually has a role to play in making us who we're meant to be. You know, it brings out of us endurance. It brings out of us patience. It makes us creative. If I did not have to get up and think about films, I would not be doing half the thinking I'm doing.
Wow. Proof perfect that films can do you right.
Very good.
If I'm understanding you correctly. As we've said a couple of times, Humans is airing at the moment on ABC 2. It kicks off on, it shows at 8:30 p.m. on Monday nights. It's up to what, episode 5?
Yes, it's episode 5 at the moment.
Yeah.
Tonight.
You can watch
five.
Back issues on iView, which I tried to do, but be warned, now on iView, they're starting to charge you to watch back editions. So they've got there's an expiry date on some of them.
Yeah.
But then once it goes past the expiry date, the episode is still available to be watched, but you have to purchase it now, which is very disappointing from the public broadcaster in Australia that they're charging us to watch their program, their back catalogue.
Yeah, this is what you call double dipping, I'm afraid. Because if you are, I'm a bit straight laced about this. If you are a publicly funded, taxpayer oriented public entity, I'm already paying for you through the taxes. I do not see that I should also pay for the same programming costs. Either if you make it available, then I believe it should be free. If you're not going to make it available, which is what it was in the past, then fine. That's your right to do so. But actually asking me to support you through taxes and pay for the programming, cut to the chase, ABC, bring on advertising.
Oh,
I mean, well, that's what I'm saying. There's really not much difference. You're just trying to get the money out of me a different way.
Wow. On that note, we should also mention Humans is rated M, and Mark still advises you to check it out, but we're very against the idea of paying.
Human beings themselves are rated M. Okay, so you won't find anything in it that isn't in adult life.
Okay, that's TV. Mark, let's go on to the big screen this week.
Yeah, now showing the big screen this week. Well, we're going to be talking about two guys with a history, 3,500 kilometres of hiking trail, issues with underpants, sinkholes, and know-it-all walkers. It sounds like a Nature's Own buddy movie starring Paul Rudd or Michael Cera or some younger punks, but no.
No?
A Walk in the Woods is more like a vintage attempt at the same form of bromance. More funeral crashes than wedding crashes. The Hangover? Yeah, more like the nice cup of tea over. Craggy Robert Redford plays this famed travel writer Bill Bryson, which many people might know from his book, and based on Bryson's writings about having a crack at the United States' epic Appalachian Trail, this walk mainly drags behind the droll age rider
yes,
rather than walks.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, and his gravelly companion Steve Katz, who's played by Nick Nolte, doesn't really add much to it.
Oh, I thought he was one of the better... we'll get onto that. Yeah, I thought he was one of the better elements.
We've had hike movies before, most recently in the shape of Reese Witherspoon's Odyssey Wild. So what happens when two old blokes hit the trail? The bucket list in the great outdoors, or a journey without clear purpose, reminding us that no one is really that important after all. What a downer.
I'm tired of life being all about ailments and funerals. I want to push myself.
You want to hike the Appalachian Trail?
2,000 miles.
You have gone mad.
It's my old pup tent.
It's the perfect place for you to spend the night.
2,000 people a year try to do this. Less than 10% make it. Fit people in their 20s can't do it, Dad.
You'll need a rain cover, too.
Rain cover? Why?
To keep out the rain.
You are not doing this alone.
How would you like to join me for a little stroll?
Not in this lifetime.
Next time, call me for something fun. It's like a colonoscopy.
Mark, a walk in the woods was a walk into disappointment, wasn't it?
Yeah, we've both seen this film, but I'm going to let you give the summary, honestly.
Yeah, well, you basically did it in the intro. It is based on this Bill Bryson book. Bill Bryson, in real life, went for a walk on the Appalachian Trail, this huge trail on the east coast of America, and he did it later in life, and he basically seemed to do it because it was there and because he was in a bit of a midlife funk, a late life funk, didn't really know what to do. Oh, I'll just go and hike this trail. He called up all his mates to do it, and the only one that answered the call was his longtime friend of his, Steve Katz, who he hadn't seen for many, many years. Played by Nick Nolte in the film. Robert Redford plays Bill Bryson, as you said. And so the two of them go off on this hike. And the fact that it's based on a real life story would suggest that there's something to this.
And backing it up with acting talent, like Robert Redford and Nick Nolte, think, okay, how could this possibly go wrong? Well,
and
it's here.
And it was so predictable, it hurt. And you know it's based on real stuff, but it felt like a movie that was constructed around this idea. So here's the bit where kept coming up all the time. Here's the bit where you get to the annoying hiker. Here's the bit where the bear is going to show up. Here's the bit where there might be some issue with underpants or a tent collapses or they go and think about getting in a car because they don't want to keep walking anymore. But the stuff that you'd expect more to come through this kind of story, given it's based on a Bill Bryson book, I've read a couple of his, particularly a long time ago, and his droll and quite witty observations about where he travels and the places he goes and experiences are what makes Bill Bryson's reflections, observations, what they are. A Walk in the Woods felt like they went out of their way to drop any personality or distinct reflections from it, and instead just make it this by the numbers old guys walking the trail movie.
I
was really quite flabbergasted at why someone, and given the caliber in it, why they wanted to do this.
And there's been a bit of a build-up, you know, into the movie review world, looking forward to this, so to speak, as a piece, because of its pedigree. But look, honestly, I watched the same film as you. Did you pick up why they were going for this walk?
No, I reckon that's one of the biggest issues with the film, is that it's a directionless piece of work, even though the trail's got a direction. And like the Reese Witherspoon film Wild that you mentioned before, people getting out on the trail, you expect, particularly if you're going to make a movie about it, that there's going to be some massive purpose or point that they're going to, that they're going to find something about themselves or about life or whatever it is. The reasons that Bill Bryson gives to his wife, who's played by Emma Thompson in this film, but before he goes, are really limited and not really well explained. They basically boil down to, well, the trail's there, and sometimes a man's just got to do what a man's got to do, and he just feels like he has to chuck his jumper in a bag and jump over the back fence and go for a walk. What does that mean? And I think the whole movie suffers as a result purposelessness of what they're actually doing out there.
The weird thing is that actually I thought there really was an answer somewhere close to that. Sometimes a man has to break out. But they didn't investigate it.
But does he, though? I guess that's right. I suppose you're right.
It's almost like it's real, and because people recognise being trapped in society, but it was just like a nod to it, and then off to do.
And the strange thing
comedy.
About the depiction of Bill Bryson in the film is that he's a guy who, and in contrast to this Steve Katz, his friend, Bill Bryson's pretty much got everything, had everything, achieved everything. And as the Steve Katz character mentioned several times in the film, oh, mate, it must be hard when your life's so perfect that you want to ditch your life and come out on this trail with your drunken mate who hasn't made anything of his life. And the contrast between Bill Bryson and Steve Katz is quite dramatic, but even that wasn't really tested that much on screen. I like Nick Nolte for his gravelly persona and his gravitas that he brought to the film. But you're right, there was so much about the contrast and the ideas going on in the film that wasn't explored was a little bit ridiculous. So I'm with you. It felt directionless in terms of the director of this film, Ken Kwapis. I really liked his work on The American Office. He can direct funny stuff as well as find some real emotion and personality in what he's doing. On this occasion, this movie just felt really dry of all kinds, everything from heart, again, going back to purpose. It was, given you're on a trail and you're on a walk and you're on this journey to something, it was amazing that we didn't get really anywhere in the end.
So you almost got happy when Nick Nolte turned up on the screen, but was there anything else you liked about
the
film?
Well, I came away with something positive from the film, but I don't necessarily think the film was meant to be leaving me with this. So there is something that I liked about it. And particularly when you're watching a story about a world-renowned travel writer and you think you're going to get a life lesson that he's going to pass on to you from this epic journey that
he's
taken.
Well, it's an epic setting. It's the Appalachian Trail. Okay, it's good. It's huge. So what do we learn?
And what I think we learn is that, well, sometimes we're all the same. We're all very small. And sometimes when we go looking for the bigger meaning in life, we might not actually find it. And we might not find it where we think we're going to find it. And I think that's where Walk in the Woods, pretty much the whole way through, where it goes to and where it ends up. I don't think necessarily that's the message it's trying to put forward, but I'm not sure what the message was.
Yeah.
But
it did pitch itself as a kind of a life lesson film because he was going out to find a meaning.
But instead, all he finds is ridiculous scenes like him flirting with a waitress in the middle of nowhere that doesn't make any sense. Bill Bryson, the character in the film, treating his own wife terribly in terms of just dismissing her objections to what he's doing.
I can't see how Bill Bryson could be happy with this film because he actually comes off.
But he is, though. I saw him interviewed on the 7:30 report a few weeks ago, and he's quite chuffed, particularly getting played by Robert Redford.
I guess so.
Why wouldn't you be? But what I came away with from the film is the reminder of we're all small, we're all kind of equal, whether we're Bill Bryson or Steve Katz, we're all kind of equal in this scheme, and we may not be able to find the answers where we go looking for them. An amazing thing, amazing truth about this universe is that there is purpose to be found, and it's purpose that's quite inherent in the making up of it. God has created this universe, placed humans in it, and given us the purpose of serving him, loving him, but also serving each other and loving each other. Mm. And I think that can sound a little bit glib and a little bit trite. And often, even for Christians, you want more than that. You want to know, what's my individual purpose? What's my own direction? Where can I find that in my work or in my family or in my leisure or whatever it might be? What A Walk in the Woods reminded me is that if you're a Christian and you follow Jesus and you know the love of God and the purpose that gives your life, the value that gives every moment in your life, then you already have the purpose and you already have the meaning. You don't have to go and look for it on the trail or wherever it is.
You just apply it wherever you are.
So you apply it however that looks, and that'll look different in all kinds of situations that you're in. But whether you go and hike the Appalachian Trail or whether you just stay home and watch a movie on the couch, the purpose within you is to love and serve God, love and serve Jesus, and love and serve each other. However you go and do that, well, it is going to look different in different situations, but it's already there. The purpose is already there. So a walk in the woods reminded me of that. That's probably the best thing that I took away from it, Mark. Apart from some of the cameos in the film I quite liked, there were two slight, Nick Offerman and Kristen Schaal from the Flying Concord.
And Emma Thompson.
That kind of stuff. That I'm scratching for things that I really liked about this movie. Yeah. So it reminded me about the purpose that God gives us, but the movie didn't intend for me to take that.
If you like your films directionless, you'll stumble across A Walk in the Woods in cinemas this week. Rated M, it stars Robert Redford, Nick Nolte, and a painfully underused Emma Thompson. It's being released nationally at cinemas from Thursday, August 30, though probably you want to wait for the DVD release.
Yeah. It looks like through A Walk in the Woods that Bill Bryson figured you're never too old to try something new, even if it seems too hard or too daunting. And perhaps you can feel the same way about the internet. I don't know about you, Mark, but I think...
I'm daunted by the internet.
Speaking
daily.
For the older generation, that big, scary, vast internet.
Where is my walking frame?
yet you also might want to reach people through the amazing communication portal that is the internet, because sharing a Christian faith is a purpose that you and your church community feel strongly about. Now, if that's you, if I've just described you, then you should go to insights.uca.org.au. That's right, insights.uca.
Or Google Insights Magazine.
That's right, .org.au. And check out 12 tips for sharing your Christian faith online, which is basically a starter's manual, 12 basic tips for getting you up and running on the internet, sharing your Christian faith.
This is a valuable thing because I think Christians are too ill-considered about often the great difference between how they are in real life and how they are in their real life online.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel people should think about
that. So Insight's a big supporter of this show, and we're a supporter of what they're doing. Go and check out their 12 tips for sharing your Christian faith online.
Well, here's what you can do at cinemas this week. You can see Meryl Streep, aging rocker, in Ricky and the Flash, or Zac Efron's DJ Wannabe in We Are Your Friends, or check out the Godfathers of Gangster Rap in Straight Outta Compton. Such a jukebox of screen sounds got Ben and I toe-tapping about the old movie soundtrack.
There is so much music on screen at the moment. I don't know if people have stopped and paused about it, but there are so many movies about music. So we started talking about soundtracks.
And we think that's a good idea. Now, we don't want to confuse movie soundtracks with movie scores.
Sure do not.
Because movie scores are that largely instrumental music composed that specifically match certain scenes and sit behind things, lift up and change films. But no, we're tuning into the soundtrack, the collection of songs featured in a movie, well, most of the time, that often emerge as a standalone album. Who can talk with real authority about these bestsellers that follow the bestsellers?
Who could do that, Mark?
Well, Ben spoke this week to Matt Pakovich. Matt's a film reviewer and one of those people, those helpful people at JB Hi-Fi, who upsells you that box set you swore you wouldn't buy.
He's one of those guys, yeah.
Curse you. But who better to bring the noise on the soundtrack's marriage of movie and music? What makes for a good one? What's a solid gold example of a good soundtrack? And how the soundtrack has been affected by changes to music distribution?
When did movie soundtracks begin to take on a life of their own? Like, was there a particular point where they started becoming their own entity, where they were getting sold separate to movies?
I think the decade you got to look at is the 80s. I think there's two factors because of it. The first would be the advancement of like home entertainment technology, like cassette tapes and later CDs and CD players.
Sure. And some people would be laughing right now saying advancement of technology.
Yeah.
But you're right, at the time it really was.
It really was. And then the other thing you got to think of was that this is when MTV came about as well. Essentially, these promo clips for these movies were used as extended trailers for the film. I mean, you got to think of the big soundtrack hits of that time, Footloose, Dirty Dancing, Top Gun, Ghostbusters. I mean, the list goes on. You got to think about these film clips as well. They show the guy singing the song. Then they also show like Kevin Bacon dancing around as well in the middle of rural America. And it's plugging both the song and the movie at the same time. And so people will look at this and they'll think, wow, Great song, great movie. I want to watch the movie and buy the soundtrack. So it's a win-win for the movie company and also the record companies that they're affiliated with.
Or you're a kid like me who, when like a movie like Cocktail came out, that Tom Cruise, Brian Brown movie, I never saw that.
Yeah.
I bought the soundtrack because I bought into watching the film clips of the Beach Boys singing that Kokomo song. The soundtrack became so big, it didn't even matter if you saw the movie. What do you reckon makes for a really good movie soundtrack? Give us a couple of examples.
I think a really good music soundtrack needs to be an extension of the movie, not merely a cash-in. It has to really capture the personality and if it can, even the story. So a couple of examples of that. The first is The Color of Money. That's the Martin Scorsese film from 1986.
Yep.
Starts Tom Cruise and Paul Newman. So Scorsese is always great at choosing songs for his movies. I mean, the guy's just a genius at it.
Yeah, he's done that pretty much all the way through his career, hasn't he?
All the way through. I can't really think of anyone that he's really worked with in regards to a composer. Like, you think Steven Spielberg, you think John Williams. I can't think of that for Scorsese. When I think Scorsese, I think like Rolling Stones.
Yes.
Or in the case of The Color of Money, Eric Clapton, is that song the way that you use it. Now, whenever that song comes on, the first thing that I think of is that movie. I think of Tom Cruise and Paul Newman shooting pool in these pool hall dives. And the rest of the soundtrack kind of goes with that as well, kind of bluesy songs. You've got B.B. King and other ones as well. And another soundtrack that I really think of, and going back to your Cocktail thing, was the Pulp Fiction soundtrack. Now, I heard songs from that soundtrack before I watched the movie because,
yes,
of course, the movie,
yep,
came out. I was too young to watch it. But I remember that Urge Overkill did a cover of the Neil Diamond song, Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon.
Oh, yeah, I remember that too, yeah.
Yeah, so that, and of course, that goes back to the film clip. I remember seeing the film clip and heard the song, and I see Travolta there. I was like, well, what's Travolta doing? I haven't seen him since Look Who's Talking Part 2 from like 5 years before that. Those are like two examples of how a soundtrack can take classic songs, whether redone or new songs, and then they can really evoke the spirit of the film. And when you hear them, even to this day, the first thing you think of is that movie.
Music distribution models have radically changed during the past couple of decades, particularly, what did you mention before, cassette tapes and things in the 80s. And you think about now, we're a couple of decades on, and look where we're at. How do you think that's affected the movie soundtrack?
All across the board, CD sales are down, and nothing's going to save it. And even the prices of CDs are down. When I first started working in retail 10 years ago, average price for CD was $30. Now it goes from maybe around $12 to $15. It's just how it is. The soundtrack has gone the way of other CDs. The sales are down from it. However, the interesting thing about soundtracks is the extension of a movie. So something like Twilight, for example, what will also be released is the songs that are inspired by the movie.
And that means, Matt, basically, that the song didn't even have to have been in the film, have nothing really to do with the film, or it's just sort of loosely connected to the film, and so they put it on an album and sell it.
Exactly right. And they know their target market well. Who was watching Twilight? It was the younger teenage girls, maybe some boys as well. They want everything Twilight merchandise-wise. And what do they want? They want the soundtrack. Now, while the soundtrack, the songs weren't in the film, it says Twilight. It has Twilight on the cover. But you just got to look at something like Frozen as well, like huge movie for Disney. That soundtrack for Frozen was the third highest selling album last year, according to 2014 ARIA charts.
Whoa.
And it's still in the top 10. And that movie came out, March, April last year? Same with the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. That was songs from the 70s and 80s, because the character Star-Lord in that film was from that era. And that thing was like number 22 last year. So there are soundtracks that really do break through and sell well, whether they are extension, whether they are used in the movie. It really depends on the popularity of the movie and who the movie is marketed to.
And that marks that marks, Mark, the end of discussing soundtracks. Now you know everything you need to know about soundtracks. Thank you very much to Matt for filling us in on the world of soundtracks. You can check out Matt's film reviews at mattsmoviereviews.net. That's right, mattsmoviereviews.net, which is a nice name for a film review site, but nowhere near as good as our website name, Mark. What is it?
TheBigPictureWebsite.com.
That's right, TheBigPictureWebsite.com.
You know, I remembered that without any strain whatsoever, because it's not the-big-picture.
And one of the regular listeners to our show, Stuart, commented that he thought that was one of the best does-what-it-says names on the tin names better than maybe since Snakes on a Plane. Snakes on a Plane was the last good one. Now there's the bigpicturewebsite.com. Does what it says on the tin. Go and check it out.
And this week we've actually been adding, I won't say we, it's the corporate we. Ben's been doing a lot of work. Adding articles too. So we're now starting to beef it out. So you can not simply just watch videos of the show or, for that matter, listen to past episodes, which we'd recommend because there's some great stuff back there. But you can actually look at the articles that build out the beefs behind some of these concepts.
And feel free to use some of these resources with your friends, with the different groups that you're involved with. When you want to talk about movies and TV and the deeper stuff in them, the Christian ideas, the way all of this intersects, check out the various content we've got at the Big Picture website.
But taking a lead from the ABC, if you do try and look at a back issue, we will charge you.
Not true.
It's all free. We're actually better than the ABC at that. How's that? Topping the ABC.
Yeah. Moving on to the first soundtrack choice this week. What better way to go into our soundtrack selection this week, Mark, from the press record segment on soundtracks to some choices that were based off what Matt was discussing in that segment. So he got me so fired up when he was talking about Cocktail soundtrack that we thought we should play this.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy.
Bobby McFerrin, Don't Worry, Be Happy. That's taken from the Cocktail soundtrack. In 1989, Mark, that won the Grammy for Best Song of the Year, and it was actually re-released the year before because of the success of the film Cocktail, because it was on the soundtrack, and it knocked off Sweet Child of Mine, the Guns N' Roses song, from the number one spot on the Billboard charts in the US. Amazing. I think it's the only time Guns N' Roses have been knocked out by Bobby McFerrin. On a sad note, if anyone can remember the film clip to this film, it wasn't to do with Cocktail. It was this other standalone film clip. Robin Williams was in the film clip, and given the tragic circumstances in which he passed away recently, rewatching that film clip to a tune like Don't Worry, Be Happy, a little bit somber.
But this is what I'm saying. This is the fallacy of some of these sort of soundtrack successes, because Don't Worry, Be Happy has got to be one of the thinnest of philosophy you've ever had in your
life. Oh, it's a terrible philosophy.
It's a terrible idea. Because
if you think it through.
If you think, oh, yeah, no, I've just been involved in a freak washing machine accident and now have no limbs. Oh, don't worry. Why? Are you kidding me? There are real reasons to be upset about life, and simply saying, you know, you should be happy is not actually going to help anyone.
So
it's like Hakuna Matata. I'm on a rant.
Before Mark gets further onto a rant, keep listening to the delightful strains of Bobby McFerrin and think through the philosophy of Don't Worry, Be Happy.
Maybe not.
We talk too much over Don't Worry, Be Happy, and talk too much about it.
We just killed it.
The next time you hear Don't Worry, Be Happy, think it through.
Think it through, people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to work. Okay, look, the top five this week
takes us right back. We're at top five. Cool.
Takes us back to that center of an idea that we've been discussing early in the show. Early in the show, we had a bit of a go at friendship, Bill Bryson style, with a look at the film A Walk in the Woods. And that shambling relationship got us wondering about the other end of the scale, some of the best examples of friendship Hollywood has produced. Now, I accepted the challenge, five of the best friendship films to find their way to the big screen. But Ben wasn't about to let me just select any film with two people in it.
Heck no.
And call it friendship.
Too easy.
Which is why I wasn't able to manufacture an excuse to mention F.W. Murnau's 1922 black and white classic Nosferatu, simply on the basis that it was an unsuccessful friendship between a young woman and a vampire. No,
it's a pity, though. I would have accepted that.
You would have accepted it because of the black and white connection. But no, it had to be great groups of friends. Challenge accepted. This week, my top five groups of friends I'd really like to belong to that don't include a vampire. Beginning with...
5.
That neighborhood group friend genre. Okay, you know, there's bunches of films out there about that group of kids who are in the neighborhood who just seem to click well together.
Like BMX Bandits. That's your number five choice?
Didn't actually make my list.
No.
No, like Goonies. Or
is it Goonies?
No. Oh. Or Stand By Me, which is a fantastic film, but because it's been in another top five, I decided not to include it. Or even like on the cartoon connection sort of side of it, Frank and Weenie is a classic case of a bunch of kids who sort of work together and come together. A recent one that I thought that would come in at number five is Super 8.
Oh, yeah, excellent film.
J.J. Abrams basically reinvents almost Spielberg on the screen to present us with this bunch of kids who were making a film and captured stuff on TV that they couldn't conceive would happen and get plunged into the middle of a mystery. What is happening? Why is there a train wreck? Why are all these people invading our town with, you know, hazard masks and things like that? Look, it stars Elle Fanning and A.J. Menchalka. It's a great start to our top five group of friends, but...
4.
It's going to be surpassed quite easily by that other...
Very quickly, yes.
By that other group of friends genre, the teen group. Okay, now there's lots of films, the teen group. Like, one end of the spectrum, you've got Clueless, you know, which is kind of
Or Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
Which I wasn't going to bring up.
Which is at number 4, okay.
But, or one of my personal favourites, Chronicle, is another classic sort of teen group film. That's where friendship goes
wrong.
What
did you go with?
I went with Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Oh, yeah?
And it was a fantastic film about...
Very underrated.
Yeah, I know.
And saw it on a plane. It was that
if
underrated.
If people have not seen Perks of Being a Wallflower, that is a great film, but please bring the Kleenex. It is very much about the tension of trying to be a teen and when things go wrong, when you're not part of the real group, the fun group, but how broken pieces can somehow support each other. And so I think it's a fantastic film. Logan Lerman's in it, Emma Watson, Ezra Miller. They are great teen performances in a great teen script. But yet again, surpassed by another great film.
3.
Okay, so if we're going to look at genres of friends, I would be very much remiss if I didn't mention the group of women that hold it together through some crisis and together, you know, become that sort of model of what it's like to be true womanly friends.
You mean like white chicks?
Well, I mean like the Little Women for a start.
Oh, okay.
I don't mean white chicks. Did you actually understand that they were two men?
Okay, thank you.
Mermaids is a classic example, okay? But for me, there is no film that surpasses this than a film I was forced to watch and grew to love. Steel Magnolias.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, 1989, Shirley MacLaine, Olympia Dukakis, Sally Field, Dolly Parton, Julia Roberts, Daryl Hannah in the one film.
That was mentioned on our last show, the Power Edition, Power Women Edition, and we had a bunch of real-life women tell us what films they loved that were particularly targeted at women or about women. Steel Magnolias turned up on that
list.
So
if you're looking for a film, if you're like a bunch of girls sitting around thinking, what could we have a women's night? You know, we could all get together and watch a film together and enjoy it. If you have not seen Steel Magnolias, go see that. It's a brilliant film, but not as good as number 2.
2.
Okay, so the only thing to surpass the women's group of friendship film
yes.
is the men's group of friendship film.
Let's move on.
I am a bloke, so I did slightly rank this. Only slightly higher.
Because you're a bloke, because we disagree with the quality
male
of trust changes.
Male bonding is something that film has worked really hard to present, and you often see it in terms of sporting team films. One of my
favorites. Like the bench warmers.
Yeah. No, like Friday Night Lights.
Are you impressed with my memory of poor films that I'm trying to throw you off the track with?
You're incredibly
Thank
poor.
Thank you.
Okay, Friday Night Lights is like a classic of that sort of team group friendship.
Mighty Ducks.
Yes, or Task Forces. I mean, you're like sometimes when they get teams of people together investigating things like the Untouchables before you get something awful in there. There's another classic case of a group of friends who have to work together to solve things. Or even Quests. I mean... The Lord of the Rings is based on a group of friends.
Well, they became friends.
Well, they did, apart from Boromir. Let's not mention the nasty incident about trying to kill someone. Yeah. But anyway.
Did you go with?
Well, I went with Star Trek. Don't look at me that way. I'm telling you now that Star Trek is the best model of group friends ever. Okay. William Shatner. Because
everyone needs a Spock in their friendship
group.
Yeah,
William Shatner, Leonard McCoy, DeForest Kelly. You're basically looking at Kirk, you're looking at Spock, and you're looking at Bones. And there's they're basically the three sides of the same man. You've got DeForest Kelly going, "Damn it, Jim, he's a real man, don't you understand?" And you've got Leonard Nimoy coming in as Spock and saying, "I think you misunderstand, Doctor, the nature of this problem." And Shatner chiming in with, "Spock, you don't really realize what's happening now." You know, and
well, it sounds like they were the three sides of the one man you.
Yeah, I know.
You're the one man Star Trek.
I am. So, but look, Star Trek V has that moment where in which all the Final Frontier, 1989, all three the characters come together and basically have to deal with the fact that one of them is going to die. And look, I'm not going to spoil the film if you haven't seen it. It's a brilliant film. It was actually directed by William Shatner. And it stars, as I said, Shatner, Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly. It's a great model. I think so much in science fiction has tried to recapture that sort of model of friendship, you know, between those guys. But when we come to the best friendship group film...
One...
Now, I just want to point out at the top of the show that you mentioned that this show is going to include Shirley MacLaine, she was in Steel Magnolias, William Shatner, he was in Star Trek, and you mentioned Drew Barrymore, and we haven't had Drew Barrymore thus far on this top five list. Am I right in expecting that the number one choice does indeed star Drew Barrymore?
Indeed it does, though probably a Drew Barrymore that most people won't recognize.
So it must be, I'm trying to think of the worst Drew Barrymore film, Never Been Kissed.
Yes. Never Been Kissed.
That's a surprise choice. No.
E.T., the extraterrestrial,
has got
to be the best friendship group film ever.
So it's like the alien friendship group movie type.
It is kind of
type.
It really is. It brings a whole bunch of sort of types together, but it is kind of like that group of kids in a town again. If you know the storyline, you'll know an alien basically lands and has to try and get home. E.T. phone home has become one of those sort of embedded film lines almost in consciousness. Directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Henry Thomas and Drew Barrymore. It's impossible to emphasize how much this film connects with people, or for that matter, my wife, who would literally have divorced me if I had not put this in at number one. But she didn't have to argue, because the truth is, it is an incredible film. It was the highest grossing film of the 1980s, the whole decade. It held this title until 1993, when Spielberg released Jurassic Park. How's that for topping your own work? The concept for the film was based on an imaginary friend that Spielberg created after his parents' divorce. And it's basically acclaimed by critics as a timeless story of friendship. You know, it's incredible the way it was put together. There's so much interesting information about it. You know, the 2'10" stuntman who played E.T., or the 10-year-old boy who was born without legs. It is incredible how it came together, and yet basically the whole thing is about childhood friendship. Spielberg films this all at a childhood eye level.
From the point of view of a child.
Yeah, so everything's seen from the perspective. Most of the story was not actually storyboarded, but shot in sequence so we could get the best performances out of the children so they could experience it as it happened. This is an incredible film about friendship. And most of all, it's a film about sacrifice. It's about everybody saying, in the end, what is this friendship worth? As a Christian, I want kids to see this sort of stuff, because it's saying friendship is measured by what I'm prepared to give up for the other. Not what I get out of the other people, but what I'm prepared to sacrifice for them. And in that sense, you can see that friendship really is a God-given thing. You know, God is the sinner's friend. Why? Not because we give anything to God, because God's, you know, thrilled about what praise we might give him. But the fact is that he gives up for us, and we realize that is what makes a decent friend.
In this quiet neighborhood, on this tranquil street, a mystery is unfolding. And an adventure is beginning. Again.
I'm keeping you.
In March 2002, Steven Spielberg's masterpiece returns to theaters everywhere.
What's he doing?
E.T. Phone home.
From the 20th anniversary edition, which we own,
Of course you do.
I've got to say, it's brilliant.
Otherwise, grounds for divorce. Moving on to the second soundtrack choice for the episode. So earlier in the show, I spoke with a guy called Matt, who is a movie expert and also a music expert. Coming together, he talked about soundtracks. And from that, the first soundtrack choice for our show this week, I went off the back of what he was discussing, and he talked about one soundtrack in particular, Cocktail. Now we come to the second choice. So I went with a selection from Pulp Fiction. So Matt was talking about great soundtracks. He picked up Pulp Fiction, and he mentioned that Quentin Tarantino is a bit of a master, like Martin Scorsese, at using soundtrack song choices to score the film, to use them behind the scene of a film and really let them run through the whole scene and add some additional elements to what's on screen. In Pulp Fiction, Jungle Boogie plays underneath a quite famous scene where John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson's characters, right at the start of the film, who are playing hitmen, have this weird but kind of great discussion about John Travolta's character's trip into Amsterdam and the Royale with cheese and all that kind of thing. So Jungle Boogie doesn't just play behind them as they walk into their car, but as they get into the car, the soundtrack choice, Jungle Boogie, then starts playing on the radio in the car as well. This kind of stuff Quentin Tarantino does throughout all of his movies. If you listen to the choice of music and how it's layered throughout the film, it's really quite breathtaking. And so that's why we picked Jungle Boogie this week.
And it's a great piece of fun.
Feel the funk, yo. Let it flow.
Ben and I have had our differences this year about new films and TV shows. You're conveniently forgetting Slow West, aren't you?
I've blanked that from my mind.
I was traumatised.
Apart from how much I love that movie, Mark.
Let's talk later.
Let's move on.
We are in agreement on some films, and I've got to say that one of them is the one we're going to be talking about now for what your kids are watching, and that's Me, Earl and the Dying Girl. Is it the best movie of the year? Well, it's going to be pretty close.
Yeah, it's definitely up there.
There's so much to like about this dramatic comedy that you'll struggle to believe we're talking about just one film, but in fact we are. For its merging of movie magic and real clout, we just loved it. Although there's some unnerving ideas towards the end about teen life and ultimately how it's summed up by Me, Earl and the Dying Girl.
I have no idea how to tell this story. I don't even know how to start it. This is the story of my senior year of high school and how it destroyed my life.
Your father and I want to talk to you about something sad. Rachel Kushner has been diagnosed with leukemia.
That sucks.
It sucks.
It sucks quite a bit.
You might be someone who could make Rachel feel better.
I don't need your stupid pity.
I'm not here because I pity you. I'm actually here because my mom is making me.
It's actually worse. Everyone was going to find out sooner or later.
One thing you can do if you don't want to talk to anyone is just enter a subhuman state. Pretend you're someone annoying.
Hi, Rachel. I'm really sorry you have cancer.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Look, there's a lot to like about this film, if only because of the pastiche, the way it sort of works together. It is
pastiche, Mark.
It is comedy at one point. It is really thoughtful drama at another. It is animation. you know, and it's stop motion animation at some points, and yet it is live action drama at others. It is really quite clever. No surprise, it's made by Indian Paintbrush, the producers, this fantastic, you know, company. It is really
because Indian Paintbrush
seeing.
Have been involved with a lot of Wes Anderson movies,
and you'll see
the look and feel of this film often feels like that, but
you'll
not
honestly feel like you're watching a Wes Anderson.
But that's not we're not even having a crack at the director of this, Alfonso Gomez Rayon, who is not trying to rip off Wes Anderson movies. No. I think he's
just learned from
it. He doesn't beat Wes Anderson, but he definitely makes it his own. Yeah. All the various elements of Wes Anderson films.
Yeah. It lacks actually the sometimes alien and distancing quality of a Wes Anderson. Like sometimes you actually feel on the outside of a Wes Anderson.
Yeah, whereas this one you feel really quite within
really
it.
Engaged.
And why we picked it for what your kids are watching this week is more this is what we think kids should be watching, at least teens should be watching.
I think there's a really good chance that this will be not only what they want to watch, but what they should watch. You know, people will start talking about Me, Earl and the Dying Girl. For those people who didn't pick up the basic plot, you know, inside of the clip, it is about a teenage loner called Greg who's basically made a skill set out of avoiding conflict by just blending in with every group he forms with, and his mum who says, I want you to become friends with this girl. She's dying of cancer.
Yeah. And says, would you rather just sit around in your room than talk to a dying girl?
Yeah, and
what are you going to do with that?
I would rather sit around in my room.
But he gets forced to go and see the dying girl.
And it's really interesting because in essence, what you're looking at is the forced confrontation of a teenager with death. It is a great, great vehicle for talking about those sorts of things. What sort of things do you like?
But then on the adult front of it, before we get to the characters, so what I really liked, there are two things I particularly liked about the film. Before we get to the characters and how real they felt, the other side is the film nerd side, where this movie is so littered with film references, it's ridiculous. And a lot of movies can feel like they're talking down to you or they're just trying to be smug or indulgent for the sake of it. I didn't feel that with Me, Earl and the Dying Girl. And there is so much in here, everything from posters and T-shirts to constant references to old movies and new. But also, there's a lot of foreign film references, particularly. So I obviously like that, Mark.
Thrilled.
And
but don't worry, they can go over your head. Okay. You won't feel like you missed anything.
But if you didn't know who Werner Herzog was before this movie, you will by the end of it. And some of the reason for this being in the film is what I liked about it is it was used as a plot point, not just as oh look how smart we are. So Me, which is Greg in the title of the film, that's the lead character. Earl is his kind of mate. And they make movies together and they make these movie parodies of classic older films. And so they make movies like A Box of Lips, Wow, which is like Apocalypse Now, or Breathe Less as opposed to Breathless. And I think they did Grumpy Cul-de-Sacs as opposed to Mean Streets. So they make these like ham-fisted, these backyard movies because they're massive fans of films. But that
is
integral.
There's almost a touch of Be Kind Rewind.
Be Kind Rewind. But I think they integrate it into the story in a much more, it's funny, but it has also a kind of disarming quality about how these guys approach real life and acceptance and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I really like that. But I also like the fact that these guys and girl feel very real. So Greg,
these characters are brilliant.
It was excellent. Thomas Mann plays him fantastic as a guy who looks like he's worked out what's up with high school and he's sorted out his strategy for survival. But where that really comes from is a place of great insecurity, particularly around his future. In contrast, Rachel, diagnosed with cancer, pretty much knows what her future is, and she gets increasingly frustrated with Greg moaning about what he's going to do with his life. He's not really certain. He just sort of just wants to go along. She's very frustrated with him at not embracing the future that's going to be his. And then in the middle of that is Earl, who's played by a guy called RJ Seiler. And initially, I thought he was very limited. I thought he was just used as this cartoonish African-American teen who usually said one thing about women's anatomy, which I won't go into. That seemed to be his catchphrase for about half the movie until he gets to the point where he best summarizes Greg, the lead character. In a couple of lines, he demonstrates that his friendship with this guy, for a long period of time, he understands where he's at better than what Greg does and helps Rachel to see that as well. And for a movie that could have just come off like an exploration through stereotypes and cartoon characters and film references, it doesn't feel like that at all. That's the big reason I loved Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
I'm not going to go on about the lead characters because I think you've done a brilliant job summarizing
that. Mark.
But I've got to say, look, the background characters thrill me in this film. This is one of those films where it's got real depth. It reminded me very much like of Juno or Easy A, where the secondary characters were almost as interesting and yet perfectly supporting those main characters. So you've got a great case of a point in Greg's dad and mum, for example. These are not unbelievable characters. You've got a dad who is, in fact, actually played by Nick Offerman, who is a university professor who has a sort of perverse and bizarre experimentation going on in every strange food he can ever think of from different cultures. But you've got a mum who I really kind of identified with, who really wanted her son to engage and was prepared to force that engagement if necessary. And then, interestingly, when you look at, I've forgotten the name of the girl who's dying.
Rachel.
When Rachel's mum comes on screen, she is palpably real, sadly real. Mm. She's
paralyzed by grief.
Yeah, and she's not just this sort of cliche of a weeping grief or a struggling grief. It's grief acting out in really strange ways, like becoming overly affectionate or being a little bit too hooked on
Wine in the afternoon.
Yeah, placebos. You know, so it is one of those sort of things that you think, gosh, this is real life. These are real people. These things are knocking around like real jagged pieces.
Yeah, and so grief is a massive undercurrent going through this film, and dealing with dying and how you approach someone who's dying. And I think the film overall handles it really well, particularly from the teen side. And there's a great big scene towards the end of the film that Greg and Rachel share that is all shot in like one take, and you get both sides of the equation where Greg isn't willing to accept Rachel having accepted that she's dying. And Rachel, I thought she was a believable victim, for want of a better word, who had accepted her lot, was a little bit somber about it sometimes, other times joyful. It's kind of accepted it. Where the film ends up, though, I wasn't quite as happy with in terms of the message that it's promoting. One of the things before we get to that, because I know you've got comments on that, before we get to that, I just wanted to point out that as great as the parents are in the movie, I was a little disappointed at how distant they seemed to be in the lives of their teen kids, who they clearly loved and clearly embraced and wanted to be involved with. And I think as a Christian, as a parent, what I want for my daughter is in each situation, I want to be able to help her. You know, I'm not going to be able to be there in every situation, but what I'd like to do for her is help her to work out the person she wants to be now and into the future and how she's going to go about that, rather than letting them go off and fend for themselves. And I felt that was happening a little bit in me and Earl and the
dying girl. It was almost as if, sometimes the parents would push them in a direction and then just leave them to get work out.
Yeah. I want to understand, what's her Christian values and thinking going to do in this situation in the future? How does that help you understand dying and post-death and all of those kind of things? Yeah. And I thought the kids in this were left to fend for themselves a little bit, which is why they get to a conclusion that,
yeah. Well, here's the one reservation I have about the film. I think it's a great film. This wouldn't stop me seeing the film or taking other people to see it, but it is one you should be aware of. The ultimate piece that sort of details how you're supposed to see the universe, I'm going to give a little bit away, but it's no big deal. You should look out for it. There is a film that Greg makes for Rachel, who's dying, and it is a beautiful, beautiful, meaningless series of images. And this is basically to suggest that this is what life is. Enjoy it, okay? It's almost like in American Beauty, just watching the plastic bag blow around randomly. This little film says, look, we can get sad, but in the end, life has got to be enjoyed for what it is, because it really is quite meaningless. And there are some great things to be said about, you know, coping with grief. You can continue to learn about people long after they die, and there's a really clever way of showing them learning about Rachel.
Dying girl really shows that.
Yeah. But the truth is that as a philosophy of how to cope with grief, I think it just comes so close and then misses the mark.
Yeah.
Because there is no hope. And without hope, I don't think we are capable of avoiding the inevitable despair sitting at the end of grief.
But on that down note, let's finish on a positive by saying, go and check out Me and I and the Dying Girl. It's great. In cinemas now. It's rated M. It stars Thomas Mann, Olivia Cooke, and RJ Seiler. Go see it. That's in cinemas. Also in cinemas this week, Mark, bringing us to the conclusion of our program, Straight Outta Compton is on screens. It's been a massive success over in the US. A sequel is already on the way. If you don't know, this is based on the real story of the birth of gangster rap in the US. There's a group called NWA. It's effectively like Boys from the Hood, but for real. And it's about hip-hop and controversy and that kind of thing. So for anyone who loves their hip-hop and their controversy, go check out Straight Outta Compton. Also out, if you can believe this, The Transporter Refueled You know that series that Jason Statham, the British actor.
The first one was really good.
Yeah, it was all right. It was a good like knockabout action film.
The second one was meh.
And the third one was... This has got some guy called Ed Skrein, who was in season 3 of Game of Thrones, apparently. And it's got more revenge and Russians and femme fatales and sidekicks, and he's a driver, and then who beats people's heads apart.
Sounds like they shouldn't have remade Bourne Identity, and honestly, you know. They shouldn't have.
Yeah, so we're obviously not really keen on that. Nah. What I'm interested in, though, is a film called American Ultra, which stars Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart. And Jesse Eisenberg seems like a stoner version of Jason Bourne in this film, yes. where he's just some guy who's whacked out off his head, but it turns out he may or may not be a hired assassin and people are coming to kill him. So I'm curious to see what that's like. It didn't go so well in the States. Then at home, if you want to bring some DVDs and Blu-rays home, Mark, I know you've probably already done this. You've gone and purchased My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic, Season 4.
Thankfully, I actually don't have any daughters in my house to please.
Oh, maybe it's okay, just so me who's loaded up on season. Yeah. If you missed the first three seasons,
all Clone Wars over here.
Other TV series that are out this week that took my notice. Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Season 2. I saw the first season of this, really liked it. I liked that it was just a sitcom. That was it. It wasn't trying to reinvent the wheel necessarily. It was self-contained episodes, pretty funny, set in a cop shop in New York City. Good, largely like all ages entertainment. A really funny show. I haven't seen the second season. Keen on it. It's out now on DVD and Blu-ray. Also out, Better Call Saul, which is the spin-off from Breaking Bad. Haven't watched it. It was on Stan, I think. Desperately keen to see Better Call Saul. It's out now on DVD and Blu-ray. So is Hot Tub Time Machine 2, Mark, which is the sequel you were waiting for.
Ticking that off in the calendar.
And
I can get past it.
The Mad Max anthology box set thing with all the films, including Mad Max Fury Road, which we've got something coming up on the show next week that links into that, which we'll get to once you've told us, though, what's happening on the small screen.
Yeah,
first.
I'm going to be really quick on TV because I think there's only two things that really drew my attention that's coming out this week. Both of them happen to be on the ABC. That's no reflection. If they start charging you for it, you can watch elsewhere. But look, there's an interesting program starting Thursdays at 10 p.m. called Bespoke. Okay, now I'm just thrilled about this.
It's a cool word.
It's an engaging, kind of amusing and irreverent, thought-provoking look at the rise of handmade, bespoke, locally produced artisanal stuff. Okay, and just this idea.
Listen to your tone.
Handmade has become such a catchphrase. You know, it's such a hipster way of seeing things.
I know, and now we're post-hipster. And it's not like beers weren't made before the word handcraft and vintage and whatever came out.
This really, as a series, looks at what is in fact, even though this stuff sounds like it's somehow more authentic, it really still is an industry. You know, and so it's a fascinating series about bespoke things. And also, on Friday, starting this week, is Outsiders. Now, this is a really interesting series about basically groups that live on the edge of our society. You know, what makes these sort of groups? And it's interesting you should introduce My Little Pony because in episode one...
It's always interesting.
The host finds out what it's like to be accepted by Europe's largest gathering of My Little Pony fans. Okay? And then he attends his own funeral at the near-death fiesta in northern Spain and then discovers his inner heavy metal Viking in Sweden. These are all basically groups of what it's like to live on the edge of society. And I think sometimes tolerance at least requires us to acknowledge that these people aren't just as nutters, you know, as they might seem.
That's this week on the small screen. So coming up next week, the Mad Max link. Mark, what's going on?
Oh, we've got the end of the world next week, people. This is not so much a prediction, it's a fact. Next week, it will be the end of the world.
And it will star an interview with Mad Max's wife that you've done. Also, the Maze Runner Scorch Trials, Planet of the Apes, the 100. So I'm saying get ready for Apocalypse. Wow. See what I did? I am Ben McKechnie.
I'm still Mark Hadley.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production and part of Hope 103.2's family of podcasts and vodcasts.